On the radio, you can hear news headlines and political speeches about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but the day-to-day experience of soldiers fighting those wars can be hard to relate to. The Stanford Storytelling Project wanted to make sure those voices are heard, so they produced Returning Home, Voices from the Front, for their program State of the Human. It features six Stanford students and alumni, all recently returned from battle. And today, we're going to hear what they had to say.
I was such a hippie when I was in school. Oh my God, before I joined the Marine Corps, it was actually hilarious. Everyone was so surprised that I joined the Marine Corps because I was always that kid that was like, the government, man, the government's trying to bring you down, man. They're oppressive and freedoms and man. And then all of a sudden I was in a Marine uniform with boots on and everyone was like, whoa, hold on. What's going on here?
Well, I decided to go when I was like two. So no, I'm just kidding. But I did decide to go when I was really young. But when I decided to enlist, I was 17.
I actually had never heard of West Point until I was a sophomore in high school. Most kids from my school, if they go to college, or you know, a lot of them go to Ivy Leagues or pretty, you know, nice colleges, and I just wanted something different. I wanted something challenging.
If I was going to do something as stupid as join the military as a chubby kid from the suburbs, that I was at least going to do the hardest branch of the military, right? My brother had one buddy who was a Marine mortarman, and he was a real badass, and he was sort of kind of laughed at me when I told him I wanted to join the Marine Corps, which is exactly the response that you want. It's a very interesting self-selection when if a guy tells you you could never do it and you go do it, well, it's of course you could be a good Marine.
The West Point, you know, way of life, the history, the prestige, the opportunity, it always clicked for me. The way I saw it was I was going to spend 4 years here, graduate, and then go take a unit in Germany and golf on the weekends, and that would be just about it.
I was living in New York City up till about just a couple of months before the Twin Towers fell, and seeing the soldiers in the news, they looked very tough, and it looked like they were actually doing something with their lives and just making a difference, and I wanted to be a part of it.
The best way that I can describe it is that our country was going to war. And I was 18, 19 years old, of sound body and mostly sound mind, and there was no way that I was staying home. Boot camp is exactly what you think it is. It's hell on wheels. It's terrible. I stopped having nightmares about Iraq a long time ago. I still have nightmares about boot camp.
Freshman at West Point, you're basically, you know, the dirt. The minute your parents leave, and they give you 90 seconds to say goodbye to your parents, and then they just start yelling at you. And from there, you know, they shave everyone's head, and you're up at 4 every morning. You're just constantly getting yelled at for the tiniest things.
You're not even allowed to use first-person pronouns anymore. You have to say, this recruit. You can't say him or me or anything like that.
But like they would just do ridiculous things, but you can't do that. That's not legal. You can't do that to somebody. But they would get away with it and you would just have to like just take it. I mean, we had a lot of people like try to commit suicide, people try to run away.
I had prepared myself for that particular environment that I'm just going to approach it like a robot. I have no emotion, not going to let anything get to me. I get a command, I do the command, I get the next command. That's it.
It's not as physically demanding as you think it might be, although you've never done anything in your life as physically demanding as this. But what it is they mentally break you down. They take from you every single piece of your individual identity, and they make you work as a team.
So in one way, it's like horrible because you're stripped of everything that made you you. But then another way, it's actually very like equalizing because then everybody's the same. Like there's no black, there's no white. You literally lived and slept and showered and ate with like 20 replicas of yourself.
The drill instructors and your other recruits, they don't let you fail. I needed structure in my life. I couldn't push myself in the ways I needed to. And it was after I'd given up on myself several times in boot camp, I awoke to this idea of, oh, this is what it's like to really push myself. This is what it's like to defer gratification to a later date and a possible higher level. And this is what it feels like to give up sleep to help other people do things. It's addictive when you start to get used to it, this sort of self-negating, other-focused, with all this highfalutin rhetoric about honor, courage, and commitment, right? The core values of the Marine Corps.
During the invasion, you know, there wasn't a single day that was like the day before. And the situation on the ground was rapidly changing because it was an invasion. And, you know, a few weeks into it, that we had toppled the dictatorship and things, you know, changed even more rapidly. So it was, you know, so sometimes there would be fighting, sometimes there wouldn't, sometimes we'd be chasing an enemy, sometimes we'd be, you know, trying to secure some town, sometimes we'd be talking to civilian populations, sometimes we'd be, I went sightseeing once, I went to Babylon, which was a heck of a place.
So when I got there, I was obviously very worried that it was going to, that, you know, as soon as you land the plane, people are going to start shooting at you. It's not like that. You know, I mean, it technically is a combat zone, but it's not like you're really flying in, like rockets are going off near you. It's nothing like that. You're going into like a very well fortified military position. So you're pretty safe.
The very first night I flew in, I remember there was a rocket that came in and exploded right outside the building. It was the very first time I was sleeping. So I woke up and I heard the explosion and the sirens go off. And when the sirens go off, you're supposed to go down to the bunkers. So that's what I did. I like walked down there and I went to the bunkers and I just sat there for an hour until it was all clear and I could go back. I remember just like sitting in the bunker and thinking thoughts like, if a bomb's gonna come and hit me, I'm gonna be dead already by the time I come down, you know? So it doesn't make sense for me to be sitting in a bunker. I'd rather be getting sleep or, you know? So the next time, I remember a couple hours later, actually that very night, there was another, incoming mortar and I like woke up. And then I rolled back and went back to bed.
It just was not what I expected, because I expected it to be like the movies. Guns and fighting. And basically, you're a cowboy with no rules. And I was like, oh, this is awesome. This is like every guy's dream. And there's a little bit of that, but there's a lot of sitting around.
Boring. War is boring. War is so boring.
Okay, so it's hot, very hot. You're so soaked to a sweat that if you jumped in a pool, you would not be any more wet. There's definitely a distinct smell in Iraq. So if I smelt it right now, I would be like, oh, that smells just like it does in Iraq. Something's always burning, it seems like. Either their food or the trash. You know, then we would burn our trash. And we'd also burn our, I mean, how do I say this appropriately? Like, we would burn our feces. Because you go to the bathroom in wag bags, and then it's like a little plastic bag that you seal up, and then you burn it. So, you know, you'd have that smell too. I mean, it was just, yeah, it's just gross.
I remember getting there that you're never quite prepared for it, but you're driving down the road and we get to this, you know, little village and it's on fire. And there are IP trucks all up and down the road and they're shooting and there are dead bodies everywhere. And, you know, I had seen dead bodies before, like, you know, burying your grandma or something like that, you know, very clean and aesthetic. And here there were just parts everywhere. And the, you know, that expression, pools of blood, you always think it's a metaphor. It's actually quite literal. It had been raining since that morning, and the rain had created these puddles, and there were so many bodies everywhere that were shot so many times that everything was red and muddy. And it's what made that day difficult is that makes it slippery. And when I was trying to get covered by this wall, I ran up there and slipped and was sliding like a guy sliding for home plate through this sludge of blood, and I wound up next to this guy who was laying dead on his back, and he was just looking off into space. His eyes were still open, and I have no idea why I said this, but I slid into him. My knee hit his head, and I went, sorry. I have no idea why I said that. And that was day three. And for that to be day three and do 15 months there, it was just a very primal experience.
A suicide bomber drove himself into our building. Luckily, guys on the roof saw it, started shooting at him, killed him, and he detonated. But his car was rigged really heavy with explosives, so it was really, it threw shrapnel everywhere. And then it busted out all the windows in the in every building that we were in. A lot of guys like took glass and in their body, which is essentially shrapnel. That's what shrapnel is just debris flying. And then, you know, I had some shrapnel in me that, you know, I didn't feel it when it happened. It was kind of after the fact kind of thing, which is pretty common because of adrenaline. I mean, I got by pretty easy, to be honest. I just took a little bit of shrapnel. Some guys got wounded a lot worse. And in other encounters in Iraq, guys got wounded, obviously, much worse than taking a little bit of shrapnel. So, I mean, it's kind of a, you know, sometimes I kind of feel bad about having a Purple Heart when you have guys that are triple amputees. But that's the story. Yeah.
That was another thing. It wasn't too long into the tour where I killed somebody for the first time. And that was a very memorable experience where I was in a tank and we had an infantry squad on the ground. They were moving from their vehicle to another building, and they were kind of out in the open for a minute. And we started getting fired from what looked to be three people and a machine gun. And I remember telling my gunner to get on that. And I remember when the sights lined up, I'm like, yep, that's the right target. And started shaking. And they got the breech block where you have to lift this handle in order to arm the cannon. And I remember reaching out my hand to pull up the lever, and it just wouldn't go. And it was shaking too much. So I had to throw like my entire arm and hook the lever into my elbow and just kind of stand up and jump to get it there. And I never forget, you know, all I had to do was say one word. And I looked at, down the sights, and I just said, fire. And whoom. And I saw, you know, just a black cloud that exploded horizontally. And I thought, holy shit, I just killed some people. And I didn't feel too excited. I didn't feel regret. I definitely didn't feel bad for them. I mean, they were shooting on my guys. I mean, it's a no-brainer, but, you know, it wasn't a real high-five moment. It just was very stoic. It was very devoid of any color of any kind. It was just an empirical scientific event. You were here 1 second, and now you're not. Sorry about that.
You're listening to Returning Home, Voices from the Front. It's a production of the Stanford Storytelling Project presented by KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney. This documentary features 6 Stanford students and alumni, all recently returned from wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now back to their stories.
I was fortunate to learn Arabic in the military. They sent me to school to learn Arabic. So when I got overseas, I got to interact a lot with the people.
We were there for the coin stuff, the counterinsurgency. So, I mean, we had Iraqi interpreters with us. So we go around and we do what's called knock and talks, which you just go around the village and you knock on the door and you talk. That's pretty simple, but, you know, you're just trying to gather intelligence.
But digging into these people's lives, you really got to see that, yeah, in one sense, they're terrorists and they're on our high-value target list, but in another sense, they're just regular family people and they have certain motivations. Now, that doesn't in any way justify what they're doing, but life is definitely not the black and white.
We were staying at a village in the Al-Anbar province in, like, 2006 or 7, and we had been talking to this one particular couple of families for a while, a few days maybe. And I think we were staying in their house or nearby, but we were talking to them on a consistent basis. So we ended up having to leave for a little bit to do something in a different area. So we left for maybe 5 days a week, and then we came back to that same village, and the family had been murdered. And I kind of remember coming back in and seeing the houses that looked like they had been burnt. And usually they sleep outside when it's hot out in the summer. The families a lot of the time do, because it's a lot cooler outside than it is in the homes. And so they had been, you know, you could see where their pillows were, and they had been shot and executed in their sleep. And there was kids in the family, and then they had been dragged inside, and then their, you know, their whole house was just on fire. So, I mean, by the time we got there, it must have been on fire for a couple of days, because the whole thing was just kind of scorched and the fire was out. And, it's definitely sad. You know, you have little kids getting killed and then set on fire. That's not a nice story. But, I mean, at the time, if I'm remembering correctly, I definitely didn't, like, shed tears over it. That sounds bad, but, you know, when you're in that environment on a consistent basis, I mean, it would take a lot, you know. Yeah.
When he came back, his mom and dad and his sister and me, it was us four, we were all waiting, and it was at night. There was a band playing, and we were on like short little stadium seats, and the buses, you would see them pull up, but you had no clue which one he was in, and you would just be, you know, eyeballs just peered out, just trying to grab anything that looked like him. And I picked him out because I, growing up with him, like I knew exactly his silhouette. I knew the way he walked. I knew the shape of his head. So even in the dark, I could pick out which one he was. And as soon as they basically said, free to go, I tried making a beeline and I just grabbed him like a koala. But I still have that picture. And it's just, whoosh, just complete, my God, it's finally over. Like I can actually feel you.
You know, your most important relationship with my wife, you know, that is, I wouldn't say, it has been changed. I mean, a lot of times, part of the struggle to get back is to tell her that, you know, that the guy you married was killed in action. The guy who came back is a totally different person. So, you know, that she's definitely made as much a sacrifice for whatever cause it is you think that we're believing in. She owns us as much of it as I do, because it has definitely been a challenging thing for us. But I mean, we're still together, which is a pretty big accomplishment, considering that in the Army, I don't know what our divorce rate is, but I'm pretty sure it is substantial. It's right up there with our suicide rate.
My ex-husband said the deployment changed me. I think obviously it's not very objective, but I didn't think it changed me that much. I don't know. But I think I was maybe, you know, a little less patient, and my views on a lot of different things had probably changed.
Your family knows you. They knew how weak you were and how dumb you are, and they know all your flaws and all your weaknesses. And especially my mom. She knows these things. She knows me intimately. She knows all, you know what I mean? And it's funny being over there and the ridiculous amount of responsibility and freedom you have operating overseas. And especially in the situation I was in, I mean, I'd be in charge of millions of dollars worth of equipment and several people's lives. And it was so weird coming back, and your family still sees you as kind of a, you know what I mean? I'll always be the rebellious teenager, I think, to my parents, no matter what I do. So it's kind of like, come on, Mom, like I was a soldier.
Within the reconnaissance teams, every single person except one had a college degree. And, you know, I just began to notice that there was a huge difference in the way that they understood what was going on, I guess, politically more than I did. I didn't know anything. And then I really got motivated to get out and go to school.
It was exciting at first, like, oh boy, I'm going to school. So make sure I got my backpack, all my binders and everything. But it's a whole nother kind of fight where you realize just how much you forgot.
And I just remember being very, very reserved, very withdrawn. And it sounds so bad, but I remember like hating my fellow Americans because they were so trivial. They were absolutely so superficial, and I couldn't stand it. You know, people being like, oh my gosh, the water doesn't even really get hot in this faucet.
I got a D in my class.
Like, oh man, I don't even have that many songs on my iPod.
Oh my God, I got dumped.
You are killing me, man. Do you have any idea what it's like outside these borders? Like, these people are living in mud huts the size of our bathrooms and have no running water. They don't know where they're going to get their next meal half the time. And I never said anything about it. I would just sit there and like quietly seethe to myself. And I mean, I would talk about just small stuff, but I don't remember ever getting into a real discussion for weeks and weeks because I was just so disappointed. And then, I don't know, I guess all at once I kind of realized that there's a bright side to that. And that's that we don't have to worry about where we're going to get our next meal or our next cup of water. We don't have to teach our 8-year-old son how to work an AK. We don't have to do that. And that is a beautiful thing. You know, we shouldn't trivialize the poverty and the suffering that goes on around the world. And we definitely should be aware of it. And that's something we could work on. But it doesn't mean that we have to experience it to appreciate it. And I'm glad we don't.
The tarnishing effect is, you know, you can scrub it all you want. You can talk about it. We could hold hands. You know, we could do counseling. But there, the fact of the matter is, there's just no cure for it. There's no way to undo what's been done. if anyone had any idea what really went down over there, they would never say, you know, thanks for your service. They would just say, I'm sorry, and leave it at that.
There's a really interesting retired Army Lieutenant Colonel, Dave Grossman, that wrote some interesting books on the psychological and physiological effects of combat and killing and whatnot. And he said, pain shared is pain divided. And that's something that a lot of guys have a hard time learning, a lot of veterans. And so you need to go through this process of really sharing with others. But then the minute that you have a time when you're sharing and it's the wrong person and it's not okay, then, you know, that's a traumatic experience. And the worst thing you can do is open up to somebody about something that you've done and then have them judge you for it.
You've had such an increase in bandwidth. You know what it's like to see a little girl exploded into little parts. And then you know what it's like to give somebody their freedom. You know what it's like to see a well work for the first time in a village and have them love you. And then you know what it's like to, you know, have a friend one day and the next day you're putting them in something that is black and has white letters that says pouch, comma, human remains. You've seen, you know, love at its greatest. You know, wherever you came from, this unit, we're all brothers. And you would literally die in a heartbeat for any of them. And then you experience a hatred and a vengeance and a rage that is just so consuming and primal and powerful that it overwhelms all the logical circuits that they have killed your brothers and now it's all your asses. You're just the fist of God, where I don't give a shit whether circumstances put you in a crappy country or you were unduly influenced by AQI or it's unfair for you. Well, tough because you're going to eat a canister around to the face now because that was my brother.
I would never take back having been a Marine ever. It's the last thing I would ever want to do. I mean, I can't think of anything I would rather do less than take back having been a Marine. But that being said, when you're 17, you don't think about how it's going to actually change you as a human being.
I would say that what I'm trying to do is take the best of both worlds and take some of that real flat meritocracy from the Silicon Valley, Stanford culture, and then try to marry it up with the tradition, the respect, the personal integrity, the accountability that exists so strongly in the Marine culture.
You have an opportunity here to do real good on this planet. So you got to kick in. Whatever you think is hard isn't hard. Whatever you think is a struggle in your life, I tell you right now, it ain't. You can go forward, you can drive on and do something that is going to last well beyond what your time on this earth is. There are some military dudes and gals walking around here. Don't be a stranger. If you want to say thanks for your service, that's cool. I'm not really one of those guys. Just come up and say, hey, period. What's up? My name's Joe, and I'll say my name's Russ, and then we'll talk about whatever. That's what's important. You have an opportunity for a unique friendship that you shouldn't pass up. So don't worry about what you need to say. Just say hi.
Returning Home, Voices from the Front was produced by Zandra Clark and Natasha Rook of the Stanford Storytelling Project. The veterans you heard from were Dustin Barfield, Chris Clark, Josh Francis, Annie Shea, Russ Toll, and William Treseder. Original music was by Owen Callery. You can find more stories from the Stanford Storytelling Project and State of the Human online. Today's show was a special presentation from KALW News. Line producer was Liza Veal. Engineers are Chris Hoff and James Rollins. For KALW News, I'm Ben Trefney.